Tanta Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents No More Time to Dance by G. Lawrence, narrated by Elizabeth Clert. Youth must have some dalliance, of good or ill, some pastance. Henry VIII. So when they continued asking him, he lifted up himself and said unto them, He that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone at her. John, chapter 8, verse 7. Prologue. The Tower of London, 13th of February, 1542. Darkness swirls, a silent tempest surrounding mind and form. I see it not. My eyes are closed. I am the child who will not see the monsters, will not make them real. They took the block away, pushed my numb arms and legs into a nightgown, put me to bed like an infant. I said little. Darkness had fallen, upon the world and upon me, the shadow was come. Claimed as its daughter, drawn back into its womb, I had nothing to say to beings that walk in the realms of man. I am swallowed. I am claimed. I am taken. I am already dead. They put me into bed, thinking I might sleep, yet I cannot. Although I am lost in a world of darkness, sleep will not claim me. Yet I walk in dreams, wandering into nightmare and out again. A sick feeling lies in belly and brain, a nervous energy, the last hums of life as death draws close. I do not want to sleep, for then I will be more at risk, not from guards or the morning light when death will come, but from the thought of being rendered helpless, unable to offer a last fight. Who do I fear? Perhaps my husband. At times I fear he will come by night, not wait for another to do his work. I fear the sneaking step, a creak of door, the sound of breathing, hands about my throat. I think I will look into blue eyes and see that the man has gone entirely. The monster within will have claimed dominion. It is enough to fear. Not only death awaiting me on the morn, but death stealing secretly by night. Many have died here. Silent struggles, hands thrashing against unhearing walls and unseeing glass, last gasps echoing in lonely rooms. Desperate hope is imprinted on these walls from the last thoughts of lost minds, hoping someone will come, someone will save them, someone will care. Murder has often been done here. These walls were built on blood. Is it so fantastical to think murder might happen to me? Perhaps. Perhaps it is but fantasy, yet my mind will not stop. It will not allow me to sleep when under threat. All that might happen appears before my eyes, nightmares and possibilities swimming together, washing into one as the churning, swirling water in the belly of a mill pond. And so I sleep not, but am lost in nightmares. Darkness surrounds me, and I will not open my eyes to see it. I do not fear the darkness inside my eyes, as I fear to see the belly of the darkness that has swallowed me. There are monsters here. I feel them, just beyond the darkness I am within. I think there are hands, there are eyes. Here be monsters. I saw that on a map once. My grandmother laughed at my frightened face. She was justified in mirth. We all laugh at fools, and I was always a fool. Monsters are not beings of many heads and raw claws wandering the earth. They lie within human hearts. We see them not. They pretend to be people. They wear the skins of those we trust. I see their hiding places, for I wore a skin, a mask, myself. When queen, I wore a covering of stone placed on my face to conceal the girl underneath. Monsters hide so they will not be seen until they strike. I was hiding for my life, for the fantasy of a future lived in liberty and luxury, a future I might build for myself. My shell did well, my marble mask, but it crumbled in the end. It was too hastily constructed, like the glories the king made for his palaces, like the paint that was still drying when we arrived to stay in his houses. Too hasty a construction, too easy to destroy. Monsters build better cages, better disguises. They had more practice than me. Perhaps they dwell in many bodies over time, and have time to perfect their masks. And in this dream of darkness do I lie, unreal as all my realities have been. I feel so far from youth, as though eons passed as I was married to the king. Am I now an old woman? Age is relative. I die tomorrow, so this is the oldest ever I will be. I feel old, but plump, unwrinkled skin betrays me. 18. Is that an age to die? Many die young, but I feel younger than them all. Younger than all boys sent to bloody war, all girls that perish in childbed, all children that fall to fever. I have learned not much, read so little, understood so few things. My cousin toured courts about the world. I have seen only England, and only from within the court of the king. Such a small world I lived in. I will die without seeing or knowing more. Part of me thinks this a kindness. I saw not much that was gentle and sweet, but I saw goodness at times, no matter how small. Often it was overlooked by others, as kindness always is. To its cousin, cruelty, kindness seems weak, slight, thin. Yet it is not. Goodness is not frail, but mighty. Precious for being rarer than evil. In the strangest places did I find kindness and compassion. Often where I thought I would find cruelty, neglect. Not with my father, my husband, men who swore they adored me, did I find love, but with a woman who should have been my enemy, I found friendship. And it makes me think, makes me hope one last hope, that here, in the belly of darkness, in the centre of the shadow that has caught me at last, I will not find what I expect. I open my eyes at last, and I see something. In darkness there is light. A pinprick, like a cat's eye in the distance, but kinder, not as callous as a cat. Gold it shines, an orb of indistinct light. And it starts to move, dancing. Chapter 1. Oatlands Palace, July 28, 1540. It was night. A hush had fallen upon the world. Birds in the trees kept their voices to a murmur, as though they felt the importance of the occasion. Heat hovered over me, a relentless, pressing weight. The world felt oppressive that night. Smaller, hotter, closer. All the air in the world was brought to this chamber, and all was pressing upon me, heated hands, the breath of thousands upon my chest, my throat, my mouth, my lips, my eyes. The world felt small, and I large, too vast for this diminutive closed world to contain. Panic rose in my throat, an aching anxiety, a bird fluttering in my chest. Close, too close. It was all too close, all too near. The proximity of all that had been and all that was about to be pressed upon me. Fear rushed in, threatening to swamp me. My breathing quickened, and I put my head down, trying to slow it, trying to control it. I had done this before many times when the past came to haunt me. The difference was that this time it was the future assaulting my spirits. I had to remain calm. I had to fix a smile on my face, had to pretend I was this young queen, this peaceful doe, overawed by the man about to arrive at the bedroom door. I was in bed, waiting for my husband. I had to cling to the immediate, to what I had to do here and now, thinking of the future, of what might happen to me, of all that might go wrong, would only cause me to panic. If the king arrived to find me gasping for breath, choking on fear, He would hardly get the required good impression of my feelings for him. I tried not to think about how I had come to this bed, and what would happen next, but it was hard to wrench my restless mind from the path it wanted to tread. I had been a maid of court for little more than 8 months. Now I was queen. It was hard to believe, especially since I had only married the king that day and in private. Had my wedding been in London, hordes of courtiers clustered about us, gossiping, and the people of England crowding close to the palace walls, eager to catch scraps of detail, it might have felt real. But it did not. I was his fifth queen. Those before me had been cast off, killed, neglected. They had failed to be his perfect wife. They had died for it. With panic riding my back, the empty place was near, ready to aid me, to take me into the void where I could feel nothing and nothing could hurt me. In some ways, the empty place was already upon me. At times, in between gasps of breath, I was looking upon this young girl, tiny, in an enormous bed, waiting for her husband. She was not me. She was another Catherine. I pitied her for what she would endure that night. But this time it was curious. I was there and not there, in and out of my body. I was in the empty place and in Catherine. It was my will that kept this strange fluctuation going, trying to hold myself inside the shell I had constructed. I had never tried to control the empty place before. It was resistant to me. I hoped I could stand the embrace of the king, this man my mind could not reconcile. One moment kind, at another dispatching wives into captivity or death, he was a mystery, two men in one. This duality I could not fathom. Which was I to appease? How was I to know which was present? It is hard to know the thoughts of another, hard to know what they might do. People are frightening for that reason, particularly when they own you, as the king now owned me. My survival depended on pleasing him. That meant being present, at least partially, whilst he took me on our wedding night, and any night he pleased after. Any night he pleased. The ring upon my finger meant I no longer had the right to deny my body to a man. Only one man could have me, and I could not say no. Perhaps that was why Dereham sought me in marriage, I thought, staring at the heavy curtains of red velvet, breathing in and out, so there would never again be the chance I could refuse him. The hot air of the world tried to consume me anew. I held it back, breathing in through my nose, out through my mouth, calming the terror of my heart. Dereham was enough to bring on fluxes of fear. In dreams I saw his face, pinprick eyes, rage in his balled-up fists. Sometimes in daylight there would come a moment when I would feel I was watched, as Mannox had watched me. The shadows would creep upon me, and I would have to find a way to take my mind to another place, so I did not panic. They had taken enough, those men. They possessed my past. I would not allow them to own my present, or my future. Dereham was not the man I had to worry about now, nor Mannox. The king, sovereign of England, with the power of life and death over all people, was my master now. And this king had demonstrated he was more than willing to exercise this power of life and death over his wives. I understood what I had to become. I was his beautiful shell, the void he would fill with fantasies. This was how I would survive, becoming nothing of my own self, but simply reflecting his glorious image. Within his fantasy of me I would hide, until the time I might be free, truly free, as never I had been. I was glass, burnished bronze, I was surface. Substance was for others, for the dead, and for the proud. Could I do it? Become the first queen since Jane Seymour to remove enough of herself that the king would only see what he wanted to see? Perhaps. I had done it with Dereham for a time, therefore I had training in this most female art of concealment, creating a living myth so the mind of man might rest easy, captured in love that in truth was love of himself. I was to become a living mirror, my virtues passive, reflective. This would be my mask. This would keep me safe. There was no happiness in this thought, but as I knew from experience, having a plan of how to act whilst in trouble and how to escape from that trouble was a great help. It is pleasing to know that whilst your master thinks himself more intelligent than you, you are 5 steps ahead. Having a plan had kept me strong with Dereham, but escaping the king might be more challenging. There was only one way, and a natural death for the king might be fast or slow. He seemed weak and wasted, but many men lived long lives if surrounded by doctors and the money to pay for them. I would have to wait, and my mask had to stay in place. If he saw my fear of being cast off or killed, I would have failed. If he saw my revulsion towards him, I failed. If he saw the real Catherine hidden under this one, I failed. This mask was the empty place made flesh and blood. A more ambitious use for my old companion than ever it had had before. I knew not if it was even possible, and there were dangers even if it worked. Where would Catherine Howard go when this reflective surface fell upon her? What would be left of her when the time came to lift it? To two things I clung. One was in my mind, the memory of Jane Boleyn telling me the king was not a young or hale man. If that was so, then all I had to do was outlive the king. How long might that be? Months? Years? And then I would be left a free and wealthy widow. I would be independent, money in my coffers, and lands beneath my feet. But I feared there would be nothing of me left. Would I emerge a ghost of myself? Would there be only the shell left? Would I escape only to live a half-life, dead as I walked the earth, nothing left in me but the absence of his existence? If I could produce a son, I might have influence beyond the king's death. If not, I would be well provided for, able to choose my own husband, or take none at all, and become as free as it was possible to be as a woman. Then I might have time and freedom enough to dig through the layers of my disguise, and root Catherine out from the dregs of my soul, so she could live again. The other thing I clung to was in my hand, a pellet of nutmeg ground into a paste with water and pig's blood. Surrounded by soft calf gut, it was kept warm and liquid in my palm. This was to secure the notion in the king's head that he was my first, my only. I had washed my secret parts with boiled myrtle leaves and nettles, an old remedy which would pull me tight and make me bleed. I was using both tricks, taking no chances. My supposed innocence was what the king was most drawn to. I knew nothing, not only of men, but of the world, so he thought. One glance at my full figure, yet childlike face, had told him all he thought he needed to know. What a fool to think the outside shell may show what lies beneath, I thought. What an innocent to think children are left innocent by the hands of men. He would not notice as I burst it under me. I doubted he would notice a great deal besides his own pleasure. All day he had been touching me, pulling me upon his knee, hot hands wandering, pawing, causing people to stare. All that day I had felt the night to come, his frantic need, his yearning to spread my legs and dive deep into me. It would be fast and quick, the first time. He would have no control. As for what would come after, if he was able to mount me more than once, we would have to see. The king had had wives and mistresses, and perhaps he had pleased them. It was by no means certain. Many men did not care about the pleasure of a wife. They did not have to. It was not as though a wife had a choice about whether she wanted her husband inside her or not. But the king's wives had become with child, and mistresses too. Conception was more likely if a woman enjoyed sex. Yet how likely was it he could please me? I found nothing about his form attractive, and indeed would have to pretend I could not smell his rank, festering leg when he lay upon me. He was not the man I loved. I found the king charming in some ways, sweet at times, and enjoyed the presents he offered me, but that was all. Even though Dereham had scared me, I had found him physically pleasing at first. I could not say the same of my husband. So I would pretend, and hope I might pretend well enough to trick my body into thinking it found pleasure. If I produced a son, I would be safe. If I did not, any time I had with the king would be precarious, wondering which fate of which past queen I would follow. Even Jane Seymour had not been secure, and she had broken the trail I was following, that of the submissive, obedient, empty-shelled wife, a pool of water reflecting the sky above. Not happy thoughts for a young bride on her wedding night, but I was no normal bride. Think of what you can do, I thought, not what might go wrong. I had flaws which might hamper me, but attributes that would aid me. I was not well educated, but I was not unclever. I would have few allies, for I did not mean to enter into arguments of politics or religion, but I might make few enemies for the same reason. My family would make enemies, so however few I made personally, I would always have some. I looked like a child, so ambitious men would overlook me, thinking me unimportant, even if I wore a crown. I had much love in me, a generous heart and a warm soul, despite all I had faced, and people saw that, and liked it about me. And I was a survivor. I had faced men trying to crush me, and I had survived. I had got free. They had taken my body, but I had not allowed them to steal my soul, nor my mind. I would hide in pretense. I would be all the king wanted. I would hope for the best. It was all I could do. My body was his now, but my heart and mind were my own. They would remain mine, closed off, surrounded by fences I would build until such a time as I could release them. I had to hope there would be something of me left when that time came. Had to hope the person I pretended to be would not become the person I was. Hope. It is a strange beast. It seems insubstantial, yet survives much. We had that in common. A noise came to the door. For a moment I closed my eyes, willing myself to remain, to please him, to play the part, to pretend I loved a man I did not, and to save myself in doing so, asking the empty place to stay away, to only fall if I could not bear it, I opened my eyes. Pearls surrounded me, glimmering from the ornate bed I sat in. They shimmered with light from the candles, distended, fractured, yet beautiful. I hoped they would make me look as innocent as a child, as innocent of the world as I wished I was. I said goodbye to myself for a time. The mask fell upon my face as the king entered the chamber. He seemed pleased I was pink of cheek, a touch breathless. He thought it was excitement. The pageant began. Chapter 2. Oatlands Palace, July 1540. Were there any problems? Jane asked, shaking my rich azure kirtle and turning to look at me. The king had left early in the morning, a huge smile on his face as he kissed me goodbye. Sore after his many attentions, I had remained in bed waiting for my ladies. No virgin had I been, yet I was as pained as one. Myrtle and Nettle had performed their offices of tightness and irritation well. I had bled. After my women had fussed about, offering warm water and salves made of goose grease and herbs, at my request, they had left me with Jane. I shook my head. He was enthusiastic, I said, trying not to recount the memory. And now I ache. It had not been as bad as I had thought. The first time had been more an assault than love, but that I had expected. And it had been over fast. No more than three thrusts and he was spent, gasping upon my shoulder, his heated breath rank against my cheek. I lay there pretending I thought his performance magnificent, as the scent of mint lozenges floated above the smell of decay, impacted food in his teeth, and his leg rotting away. I had cast my eyes from his legs, swollen and hot, veins standing out like ridges along a hillside. I had ignored the flab of his belly slapping against my soft skin, ignored the corset he was still wearing under his nightshirt in an attempt to dupe me, or himself, into thinking his stomach was tight and firm as a young man's. Bulges of flesh popped out in strange places from the corset, especially when he stirred himself into action. In many ways this had made me pity him. Pity made it easier to whisper sweet words, to pretend, to hold the mask, so new and rigid, in place. The second and third times had been longer, but not remarkable. The king had tried to take his time, to please me, and although I had not reached bliss, those times had been better. I had not left for the empty place. I had been aware, able to fake noises of pleasure. I had been left unsatisfied, but he had been fooled. Clearly he did not think a woman would pretend with him. In truth, I had not even come close, and he had not thought for a moment to ask if I liked what he was doing. She laughed. The old goat has fire left in him, then. You thought he did not? That he would find me undesirable? No, she said, touching my shoulder. You are the most desirable of women. But, Jane's voice slipped to a whisper, Anne, she spoke of problems in the bedchamber, and that was 4 years ago. Considering he had issues with his late wife and new good sister, Our Lady of Cleves, I wondered. He mounted me 3 times. Jane's eyebrows shot up. A credit to your desirability, my queen. I would wager the king surprised even himself last night. He told me I was his perfect woman. I smiled grimly. And so the play begins. So it begins, Jane agreed. But the close, let us hope, will be glorious. Later that day I came to the great hall for another feast to celebrate our marriage. The king greeted me like Lancelot of old, bowing to Guinevere. His eyes burned with lust and affection. Jane was right. I could see him congratulating himself in his mind. 3 times! As well as a young gallant could do, surely. There was a twinkle in his eyes. I would be mounted many more times over the coming days. I could see it. If they are all as short as those endured last night, you will be fine, some rebel within me whispered. I sat beside him. Baked lamprey, mortise of capon, and codling in green sauce were brought to us. He fed me dainties from his plate, and insisted we share a cup of wine. The wine was good, helping me to fool myself into thinking I sat with Thomas at the wedding banquet I had held in my mind so many times. I tried not to look at Thomas, but I could not help my eyes stealing to him. In my mind was a fantasy of love, and perhaps Thomas felt nothing for me. But if I was to become the king's fantasy, I had to have ones of my own. Keeping a small part of me locked away in a secret place within my mind was the only way I would survive. Within fantasy would I dwell, as I fought to survive reality.
"To the queen," my husband announced, startling me. "The most perfect of women."
"The queen, most perfect of women," shouted his courtiers as I smiled gently, humbly bowing my head. Yes, I thought, to her. She would keep me alive. "I feel you," I said to the ghost at my heel. Not the ghost of my cousin so often at my back this time, but her successor. Oatlands Palace, the place of my marriage, but built by the king for his 3rd wife. I felt Jane Seymour here. Even though she had not lived long enough to occupy the queen's rooms, Jane was at Oatlands, hoping to absorb some of the glory intended for her in life, in death. She was a whisper as I walked, a moaning floorboard in the night. I felt Jane here more keenly than Anne, a curious feeling, since she had been so insubstantial in life. Yet she was the one. Jane was the one I had to be in character. They were all part of the mask I had to wear. I was constructed of dead women, Anne Boleyn in body and bed, Catherine of Aragon in manners, Jane Seymour in character, submission, and obedience. At times I felt them, ghosts of the women who had come before me, sometimes just at my heel,
a cool breath upon my neck.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?